Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and this is January 9th, right? 2013. And by the way, I post all these talks. Donna comes in many forms, the least of which is money. Probably the most important is attention and good-heartedness. And as one of those expressions of my own Donna, if you will, I try to make my own teachings as widely and freely available as possible. So if you want to hear the talk, for example, last week, right, I spoke about various aspects of meditation, or this week's presentation or talk, you'll be able to find it on my website, rickhansonson.net, and just go to the section called Audio, Buddhist Wisdom, and you'll see the talk listed usually a few days after I do it. So if you want to, for any reason, listen to something again, you're welcome to do that and pass it along to other people if you want. Okay. So we've been doing a little bit of a series on what do you actually do when you meditate? Bringing it down to earth. And the context here is that to the Buddha, he said there were three great pillars of practice: sila, samadhi, and panya, translated essentially as virtue, concentration, and wisdom. And in terms of the concentration pillar of practice, he spoke about the importance of a kind of wide open mindfulness with discerning insight, as well as the heft, the oomph, of concentrated attention. And I used the metaphor last week of the wide open discerning intelligence of the mind as like a sharpness, an acuity, like a razor blade. And the power of concentration, this laser-like ability to stabilize attention and absolutely rest it there in a very tranquil way, as the heft of a stick. So the two together become a razor-sharp machete that someone can use in a traditional metaphor to cut a path through the forest of suffering and confusion to awakening and freedom. So with regard to developing these concentration powers combined with insight, the two meet in what's called open awareness practice, or in Zen, shikantaza, just sitting. Quick disclaimer, my own contemplative training is mostly in the Theravadan, Southeast Asian wing of Buddhism. I have a smattering of knowledge of Zen, so anything useful I say comes from them, and any mistakes are my own. All right, got that out of the way. So I'd like to share with you tonight a very, for me personally, powerful piece of work developed by a neurologist and longtime Zen practitioner named James Austin, who has developed, for me, a very plausible account of what could be going on in the brain when we have a oneness experience. In Zen, called Kensho or Satori, other names come in other traditions. It's not necessarily full awakening, Nibbana, but it's still a profound, a radical, non-ordinary state of consciousness. In Kensho, you ain't in Kansas anymore, all right? So Austin is trying to wonder what's going on in the underlying causes in the brain of the mental causes of that transition from the ordinary sense of self separated from world, caught up in everyday preoccupations and concerns, shifting out into this radical state, which people describe as profoundly peaceful, free, concerns fall away, being lived by everything at once. How does it actually happen in the brain? So I'd like to share with you his account, embellished with some of my own understandings, and then bring it down into a practical consideration, and also open it up for discussion as to how to actually do this in our meditation practice and in life in general. So we're going after some big game tonight, in a very vegetarian metaphor. You know, big broccoli. Okay. So, a little context here. To create a bit of a framework, an idea of my own that may be familiar to you. As the brain evolved in three major stages, brainstem, subcortex, cortex, so did its capacities to meet three fundamental needs. I think of these as the deep down, bone deep, biological needs of avoiding harms, approaching rewards, and attaching to others. At the brainstem stage of evolution, all three needs were being served, but the attaching needs were being served in a very, very rudimentary way, with probably a major focus on avoiding harms. Then, with the advent of the subcortex, the amygdala, the basal ganglia, hippocampus, all that kind of mammalian stuff, although reptiles have some of those elements too, such as the basal ganglia, so did more capacities to approach rewards, and so also came new capacities for emotion and bonding and attaching to others. But it's still fairly rudimentary at the level of a rat, let's say. And then with the advent and development of the full flowering of the cortex with primates and the great apes that we belong to, and then humans, we have the real development of the attaching abilities of the brain. So we have these three systems: avoiding, approaching, and attaching. You can think in terms of Buddhism, the traditional language of hatred belongs to the avoiding system, greed belongs to the approaching system, and I'll add a word the Buddha did not use, heartache, really, the suffering of narcissistic injury, loneliness, abandonment, rejection, unloved, feeling dismissed, feeling unwanted, not belonging. In other words, the primary source, probably, of most suffering in the 21st century, and certainly in the more developed countries of the world, issues of attaching. I'll use the word heartache. So hatred, greed, and heartache as the three of the four great poisons in the mind, the fourth being delusion or ignorance. Okay, so you see the structure I'm working with: avoiding, approaching, and attaching. And then the brain basically has two modes, almost like two settings. When we experience that our basic needs are met in terms of any one of those three core needs, avoiding harms, approaching rewards, and attaching to others, that particular operating system of the brain goes green. It defaults, it's undisturbed, it rests in an equilibrium state, a sustainable homeostatic state that I and others call the responsive mode of the brain, in which the body repairs and refuels itself, and the mind rests in positive states related to that particular system. So when the avoiding system goes green, shifts into its responsive mode, the mind feels basically peaceful and safe and unthreatened. It doesn't feel fearful or angry. When the approaching system defaults to its resting state, when it does not feel frustrated or thwarted, well, in our mind, we feel grateful or glad or contented. And in terms of the attaching system, when it does not feel disturbed, when we don't feel like we've been recently voted off the island, right? Then it defaults to a place where we feel basically cared for, included, understood, liked, respected, valued, even cherished and loved. Right? That's the biological basis of a brain of not much suffering or craving. There's no basis for craving when we feel already full, when we feel already safe, already fed, and already loved. We've undone the deep animal basis of craving and therefore suffering and harm. I'm operationalizing here what could be going on fundamentally in the brain of a Buddha or in our own brain when we have a taste of freedom. Because then with reverse engineering, you can imagine what could it take to cultivate and create the causes of that available state of mind. This is a natural state of mind. It's what we default to when we're undisturbed. The problem is life is disturbing. You've probably noticed. It's always changing, phones ring, telemarketers call, robocalls, you know. Kids grow up, leave home, we get older, we have illnesses. People aren't always perfectly attuned. Have you ever noticed that? It's just like, I still can't believe it, you know, but anyway. And then we get rattled. And when we get rattled, the brain tips into a different setting. It's reactive mode. I think of it as its red zone, if you will, from green to red. And in the red zone, the body burns resources, long-term projects are put on hold, and the mind is colored. In the avoiding system, with qualities of fear and anger, aversion, hatred, broadly defined. In terms of the approaching system, the mind is colored with qualities of disappointment, frustration, loss, unhappiness, greed, in broadly defined. And the attaching system is colored with feelings of loneliness, rejection, inadequacy, narcissistic injury, abandonment, hurt, inadequacy, and heartache. Okay? So if you're in the reactive mode, the red setting of the brain, that drives craving and also tons and tons of self. Because when we feel unsafe or thwarted, frustrated, disappointed, or we feel rejected and alone, well, of course, Mother Nature wants us to crave, wants us to drive, to stay alive and pass on our genes. So it's very difficult to undo the conditions of craving in a brain and body and mind stuck on red. So part of the path, I think, is to cultivate a growing sense inside, a growing reserves inside that enable us to rest increasingly in this responsive mode of the brain. That's not yet awakening, but I think it's a condition of it. Okay. So I just want to introduce that notion. Then related to that, and this is where Austin comes in, and I'm going to kind of pack some stuff together, and so stop me if something's not clear. So these are the key pieces of his argument. Number one, in terms of attending to anything, which is to say focusing awareness. So if we're interested in mindfulness or concentration, it's a matter of attending. The brain does attending in terms of three fundamental functions. There's what's called the alerting function. Something has happened. I don't know what it is. I don't know where it is. I don't know whether it matters. I just know that something happened, okay? In the processing stream. Like you might have heard in the background that siren a moment ago. In the first, probably about a quarter to half to 9/10 of a second of the first beginnings of that sound. And by the way, auditory processing is the fastest to react to the world because it's how we deal with threat. You know, rule one in the wild, you may have heard me say, is eat lunch today, don't be lunch today, right? So you want to catch that sound. So in the first half second, which is a lot of time in a brain in which neurons are firing 5 to 50 times a second routinely, there's an alerting. Something has occurred. I don't know what it is. I don't know where it is. And then we orient to it. We, you know, it's out there. I found myself doing that as I was speaking. It's over there. That's the second aspect of attending, orienting after alerting. And then third comes the beginnings of a mobilization of responding. Do I need to run away? Do I need to run toward? Or can I just ignore it? Right? Those are the three aspects. Well, the first of those is distinguished in terms of neural networks in the brain from the other two. The alerting function of the brain is accomplished with networks that basically operate more toward the sides of the brain, typically on the right side for right-handed people, and they're kind of over here. And then the orienting and responding functions, where we begin to sort of think about, what is that stimulus? Where is it, friend or foe? Is it a stick or a carrot? What do I need to do about it, right? Those processing streams happen more on the interior of the brain and kind of on the inside. The localization doesn't matter that much to the useful point here. The point is they're separate. Okay, so that's a part, all right? Then here's the second part. In the thalamus, which is like this big switchboard in the interior of the brain, there are these little switches, like a little node. And they switch us between two different ways of relating to life. And we switch back and forth several times a minute. We hardly even notice it. What's interesting is to start noticing this actually happening inside your own mind. In one way of orienting to the world, that's egocentric, quote unquote, in that we are observing things as they relate to me and from my perspective, a self-referential way of looking at something. The other processing stream. The other way that the brain processes is it shifts out of this self-referenced perspective into what's called allocentric processing, where it looks at the world as an impersonal whole, as if we're observing it kind of from a bird's eye view, where this, the body that, you know, is related to our name tag at least, is just one part of everything else, and it's not privileged in any way. Okay? You see the distinction between the two? It's maybe conceptual right now, but you can kind of feel it. I play around with this myself. I mean, we're quite familiar, I think, with the egocentric perspective. So, you know, what do you think? Or do you like me? You know, we have a pretty clear sense of that. What are you doing? You know, we have a sense of that. I think we have a sense of that. The allocentric perspective is a little more subtle, but it happens all the time, where we just kind of regard life almost like Spock would, in this very impersonal, detached, just bird's eye view. Okay. Well, in the brain, basically, the egocentric view is accomplished by processing circuits that are upper, and the allocentric view is accomplished by processing circuits that are basically lower. They're older. The lower down you go, the older it is. Okay? What's associated with egocentric processing is it's a perspective that's close. So if you move your visual field from the horizon line and up, that's allocentric. If you bring your visual field down close, it's egocentric. It engages these egocentric networks and circuits. Because when it's close, it's very relevant to me. Whereas when it's far away, it's much more impersonal. It's like the big picture perspective. Okay. The allocentric processing stream is very neurologically entwined with the alerting function of the brain. Just the alerting. Pure momentary presence. Stimulus has landed. I don't know what it is. I don't know its relevance. All I know is something has changed. That's allocentric, linking to alerting. On the other hand, moving into orienting, where is it? What do I need to do about it? I need to do about it. And then beginning to mobilize a response that's coming from this organism, this animal in the wild, those two aspects of awareness, the first half second, the first second and a half or so of this moment of awareness, right? Those second aspects of orienting and responding associate with the egocentric perspective, self-referential, me separated from the world. So now here's where it gets practical, and then we'll see what you think. James Austin, he's a very cool guy. He's this older, retired neurologist, longtime Zen practitioner, kind of patrician in his manner, sort of, you know, elevated. Anyway, he asks, why is it that most historical records of people going into these states, it's really clear, people do go into these states of Kensho or Satori, oneness states. So in the Zen tradition, at least, they usually don't happen in formal meditation. Interesting. Second, surprise is usually involved. People are surprised. They're alerted, right? The alerting function. And often, they're shown looking up. The morning star, a bird, they're looking up. Isn't that interesting? So this is his theory. He points out that in the normal process of the brain, there's this switching back and forth several times a minute of the egocentric or the allocentric perspective, the self-referential or oneness perspective. That happens several times a minute naturally. These little switches inside the thalamus switch, you know, egocentric, allocentric. So imagine a wave, you know, I'll do it like this. allocentric coming up, egocentric, allocentric, egocentric, allocentric. Second, imagine that we can train the allocentric perspective through open awareness practices really focused on that alerting aspect of awareness, that very first moment on the windshield of this instant of consciousness, life just lands at the very beginning where something has happened. We don't know what it means. We don't know where it is. We don't know how we're implicated. All we have is this instant of experience before it ripples past and disappears. That's the alerting aspect of awareness, which is cultivated in open awareness practice, where we're not trying to change anything. We're not trying to understand anything. We're just being here now, utterly here now, utterly receptive, utterly letting go, all at the same time. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? We're just, the temporal moment becomes razor thin, just this instant, with a letting go continually. So we're strengthening, is Austin's theory, the alerting aspect of attention, and in so doing, we're strengthening these allocentric circuits. Because in the classic saying, neurons that fire together wire together. If you stimulate any muscle in the brain, as it were, you strengthen it. So imagine a situation where we're doing several things. Oh, one more little thing. These little nodes in the brain that switch into allocentric mode, they're stimulated by GABA, which is a calming, soothing, relaxing, inhibiting neurotransmitter. So the cultivation of tranquility, inner peace, ease, relaxation, with alertness. You got to remain alert.